Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. House Speaker Paul Ryan said today that there should be fact-gathering and not a rush to judgment of wrongdoing by President Trump. He's referring to reports yesterday that fired FBI Director James Comey has a memo detailing a conversation with Trump in which Trump spoke of the investigation into fired advisor Michael Flynn's ties with Russia and said to Comey, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go." Yesterday on CNN, Maine Independent Senator Angus King reacted.
Well, if that's true and confirmed, I think you're getting very close to the legal definition of obstruction of justice. This is very serious stuff, and we should be very careful about this.
And here's the famously sober-minded David Gergen last night with CNN's Anderson Cooper.
I was in the Nixon administration, as you know, and I thought after watching the Clinton impeachment, I thought I'd never see another one. But I think we're in impeachment territory now.
Really?
For the first time. Well, I think that the obstruction of justice was the number one charge against Nixon that brought him down. Obstruction of justice was the number one charge against Bill Clinton.
So is President Trump's request to Comey an obstruction of justice? And if so, does that trigger impeachment or trial of the president? Well, get ready to hear the word murky a lot. Alan Dershowitz is professor of law emeritus at Harvard. Hello, professor.
Hi, I'm not going to use the word murky, but I'm going to use the word nuanced. I think we have to have a nuanced approach to this issue. The fact that it was the president who made that request is a two-edged sword. On the one hand, the president is the head of the executive branch, and the executive branch includes the FBI and the Justice Department. Historically, presidents have told Justice Department officials who to prosecute, who not to prosecute. Jefferson demanded the prosecution of Aaron Burr, and in fact personally gave immunity to some witnesses to testify against him. Kennedy and Johnson played close with the director of the FBI. But since Watergate, we've had traditions, only traditions, that create a wall between the Justice Department and the president. So that's one edge of the sword that cuts in favor of the president. The edge of the sword that cuts against him is when the president makes a request, even if it's a polite request, gee, I would really appreciate if you would let it go. That could be perceived as analogous to a request from the Godfather. You know, I'm making you an offer you can't refuse, particularly when the president has the ability to fire the director, as he ultimately did. So it's a close and nuanced case. We need more information. We can get it. We can get the memos. They're the property of the United States government. I don't believe there were tapes in the Oval Office, because if there were, the president wouldn't have gotten into a credibility contest with the director of the FBI.
Yeah, well, I mentioned the word murky because I have heard you and others use it, including David Sklansky, who's a former federal prosecutor who teaches at Stanford, because this isn't just a legal question. It becomes a political one as well. We're going to get to that. Just for those saying, well, yes, there's some nuance that you just laid out, but it certainly looks like President Trump was trying to obstruct an investigation specifically into his just-fired former security advisor, Michael Flynn. That's who he was talking about. He went on, according to the memo, to say, he's a good guy, let it go. And that looks like obstruction, you know, stopping something. But does it make it even more obstruction if the investigation is of the Trump campaign and could be of Trump himself?
Sure. I mean, if he is, in fact, the subject or a target, but of course he denies that he is, and he said that Comey told him he wasn't, that would create a conflict of interest. Now, look, as a defense attorney, I go to prosecutors all the time, and I say to them, you know, my client's a good guy. Don't you think you should lay off him? That's perfectly appropriate advocacy, but I'm not the president of the United States. I don't have the ability to fire or hire the director of the FBI or promote him or demote him. So there's a difference between the president making that statement and an ordinary citizen making the statement. An ordinary citizen does not obstruct justice.
Yeah. And by the way, there's very clear examples of obstruction of justice if you remove a witness, kill somebody, or destroy evidence. That's very clear.
Because that's all illegal.
Yeah.
But when the president talks to his FBI director as the head of the executive branch of the government, that's not illegal.
Well,
he fires the director. That's not illegal. And I think we have to distinguish between conduct that is not only lawful, but constitutionally part of our system, and conduct like destroying tapes or disobeying a subpoena or obviously right. killing
but,
a witness.
But again, we are reading today in the New York Times in Charlie Savage's column that there are sections of the law that have other language. So if someone obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding, that is obstruction of justice. That sounds like influence to people.
Well, that's a terrible law. If you're a liberal out there or a civil libertarian, do not jump on this bandwagon. Just because you want to get Trump, don't try to expand these very, very expansive laws already and try to apply them to somebody you don't like.
So, Professor, just in the minute we have, if it is obstruction of justice, does obstruction of justice by a president always trigger an impeachment? And who decides?
I don't believe that this rises to the level of obstruction of justice. I think we need an independent commission to look at all the evidence and see where the evidence points. If it were to rise to the level of obstruction of justice, it would lead to an impeachment investigation. But of course, impeachment's a political, not a legal remedy. And right now, the numbers in the House and the Senate suggest that impeachment would not be realistic. But I think the appointment of an independent commission, bipartisan, nonpartisan, is a very good first step. It's too early for a special prosecutor. I don't see probable cause that any crimes have yet been committed.
And by the way, would you say there could be a chance that accumulation of things, the asking someone to just drop an investigation, then firing that person and saying you had the Russia investigation in mind, would an accumulation of things perhaps be seen as obstruction, if not one?
Certainly accumulations can create obstruction of justice. I don't think we're there yet. But I think that an independent commission looking into everything, we don't know what we don't know. There may be more information. Let's find everything before we create a constitutional crisis.
Alan Dershowitz, professor of law emeritus at Harvard. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Chelsea Manning left prison today after 7 years. The former soldier was convicted for stealing hundreds of thousands of government documents, which she gave to WikiLeaks in 2010. The remainder of her 35-year sentence was commuted in one of Barack Obama's last acts as president. President Trump criticized Obama for the move, tweeting that Chelsea Manning is an ungrateful traitor. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson has been following this story. She joins us now with a bit of a refresher course on Chelsea Manning. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Jeremy.
And take us back to 2010 when WikiLeaks started publishing the documents they had obtained from Manning. How did she get a hold of them in the first place?
Well, back then, Chelsea Manning's name was Bradley Manning.
Right.
Bradley Manning was an low-level Army intelligence analyst based outside of Baghdad. And that base apparently had a really poor information security. Manning and other service members were taking CDs and other media in and out of the computer rooms there. Eventually, Bradley Manning saw some materials that alarmed Manning and spirited them out on CDs, including what looked like a Lady Gaga CD at the time, but the disc actually contained a lot of these documents that Manning later passed to WikiLeaks.
Well, was there anything particularly shocking in what Manning leaked?
A lot, Jeremy. More than 750,000 documents altogether, some reflecting the number of civilian deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan, assessments of detainees at the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, war logs and field reports, diplomatic cables that were highly embarrassing to the Obama administration, and finally, a really important video that showed U.S. service members firing at a Reuters journalist. That video became known as the collateral murder video.
What reasons did Manning give for leaking what was leaked?
Manning, then just 22 years old, at the time cast himself as a whistleblower, as someone who was very alarmed by possible allegations of illegality and misconduct by the military. And Manning felt as if, later came out through attorneys, felt as if this information needed to come to light.
Now, Manning, so much has happened in the last 7 years, but Manning was the first one of these leakers to copy and disseminate bulk data through the internet. Did Manning create the template that Edward Snowden and others later followed, do you think?
Well, it is all under the category of insider threats, Jeremy. So Snowden went on to leak as a contractor. We also have someone charged in Baltimore, Hal Martin, who had been a contractor for the NSA and other government agencies. Even though the leaks by Manning exposed some major information security practices and faults, the government has really not been able to solve those or fix those to this day.
As you mentioned, Chelsea Manning was born Bradley Manning. She came out publicly as a trans woman after her sentencing and has been outspoken on LGBT issues since then. Has Chelsea Manning said what she's going to do next as a private citizen?
Well, she tweeted this morning and put on her Instagram account, First Steps of Freedom, and it was a photo of her feet wearing black Converse sneakers. She's been on social media expressing some reservations about life after prison, given that she went into prison at 22 and is now 29 years old. But we know from her lawyers at the ACLU, she's actually the first military prisoner to receive health care related to her gender transition, and she does want to be outspoken and make this a part of her life moving forward and her life of freedom.
That's NPR's justice correspondent Carrie Johnson talking with us about Chelsea Manning, who left prison today after 7 years. Carrie, thank you.
My pleasure.
Chef and restaurateur Barbara Lynch is one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of 2017. She's won several James Beard Awards, oversees 7 restaurants in the Boston area, including the elegant No. 9 Park, which was named Best New Restaurant by Food & Wine Magazine when it opened in 1998. It's in Boston's high-rent historic Beacon Hill area, and as Barbara says in her new memoir, it's only about 7 minutes, but a world away from where she grew up, South Boston.
I love this restaurant. Don't you? I love this one.
We met up as dinner was being prepared in No. 9's small kitchen.
Hola.
Hi, Darcy.
Good, chef. How are you?
Barbara high-fiving her prep line.
I heard the meatballs are fierce.
The walk-in fridge crammed with fresh produce.
Women have bigger closets than this. You know what I mean?
Asparagus, peppers, radishes, shallots, beets.
It's where some of her signature dishes begin.
Mousseron mushrooms and sea urchin are amazing. Mousserons are these tiny mushrooms that are really earthy. And then fresh sea urchins that you just have opened and sort of cleaned. And I can just remember opening this tiny little walk-in back here. And it's the most amazing smell.
Oh, and look, a huge plate of blondies, perfectly crisp edges, but the center's deemed too soft to serve tonight.
Oh, you should probably get rid of these, so... We will probably take these away from you because they're too rare. And so we will take them right now. Oh, my God, they're so good.
In exchange, I gave Barbara an old classic cookbook from French chef Jean-Louis Paladin.
Look at that. Potato and black truffle cake with black truffle. I'm making that next.
How did Barbara Lynch get to this point? A fan of Jean-Louis Paladin and Chef Joël Robuchon, all the great chefs. Barbara Lynch is a self-described townie from Southie. She grew up in a notorious housing project, dropped out of high school. Her new memoir is Out of Line, A Life Playing with Fire, and hers was. A heads up, Barbara's language can be as salty as the clam shack food she adored as a kid. And her life story includes a gang rape when she was 7. So a warning, but again, a question. How did she get from there to here? This is someone who, as a preteen, stole pine nuts to give her friends a taste of pesto. Now we huddled around the gorgeous photographs in the Paladin book.
This is what I want cooking to come back to.
Jean-Louis Paladin?
Jean-Louis Paladin. All the masters.
Yeah.
Like, why do we even have a round plate anymore? Everybody plates on the side of the plate instead of, like, that beautiful... bouillabaisse, I just, like, this beautiful crab mi fui. Like, it's just, everything's together instead of little dots and little, yeah. Try to figure me out, what ingredient am I? It's what? Like a painting. It's like, in some ways it's like, there's an abstract painting and then there's a Renoir. You know, it's like one is all together and then one is just, like, you're supposed to figure it out.
And you like the Renoir.
Oh, yeah, I do. I like the classics. I love the masterpieces. The yeah, that's what it is.
It's such an art for you at this point. There's no way you were coming across masters and masterpieces when you were growing up.
No, my mom, it was on a shingle and you're going to like it. I would say to her, now, Mom, would that be seasoned? Do you think it's seasoned that?
Well, but which mom, our mothers, they're the first ones who feed us, right? And your mom was an overworked mother of six kids, and yeah.
She was widowed. Yeah. You know, my dad died a month before I was born, and her mother died a month before her husband died. So I think she was kind of maybe depressed.
I just still want to get at, how did you even know what beauty was? I mean, how did you even know about what you wanted?
Gosh, I don't even know. Even as a kid, I always said, I just want to live on the Riviera. Mm-hmm. And my mother would be like, do you even know where that is?
But that became resentful on the part of your mom at times, you know. Are you going to leave us?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was that, you know, all I did. Well, I've just always tried to please her my whole life. I just spent trying to please her, but I honestly just don't think she could be happy. She was a tough one.
Well, there was much that you loved. You loved your mother's tuna fish because it had, what, pickle juice in it?
Yeah, she would stretch it out with a lot of Cane's mayonnaise. Do not ever come home with Hellman's. And then some bean bread. And yeah, Vlasic's, the Spears,
yeah.
Dill pickle juice.
Yeah. In the tuna.
Oh, yeah, stretch it out.
You followed your mother to some of the clubs here, St. Patolph's, some of these waspy enclaves, frankly, that hired the Irish women from South Boston to be waitresses. You went, learned a lot there. You're then at the elbow of Todd English, rising chef, who was a screamer. Mm. Did he really throw a bowl of spaghetti on your head?
Well, yeah, I would say more like right at me, you know, right towards my, you know, I took my earrings off and the earring fell in the spaghetti. And he's like, whose earring is this? And of course, I'm the only female on the line. But I said, yes, it's mine. He's like, you stupid, la, 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 bleep, bleep, bleep. And then whipped it at me. Well, but he did have a temper.
He did. And you also kind of faked your way through. You did a whole meal on a cruise ship without knowing what the heck you were doing.
Nothing, yeah.
Read cookbooks.
Stayed up all night. I went to the library as soon as he said, you sure you can handle this lunch? I was like, yeah, I got this.
This is the cruise ship?
Yeah.
What do you think was driving you, Barbara Lynch? I mean, it's just... You know, you're a kid in South Boston and you want to make pesto for people or you want to bake, so you go, you lifted a rolling pin. We should say you went back later as a famous chef and apologized to all the places you stole from. But what was driving you?
You know, it's funny because I just talked to one of my best friends who's in the book. She had no idea she was even in the book, Jane. And she's like, but Bobs, every time anybody tried to help you, you just ran. You ran away. And I was like, yeah, I don't think anything could hold me down, right? Back then, like, any time anybody said no to me, that was a go to me. And so I just wanted to be something. I just didn't want to live like the way we lived. I always said, there's got to be a better life out there.
You know, I'm wondering, it was pretty much a shock to be reading along. You say you didn't want people holding you down. Some people did hold you down. You were gang raped. How old were you?
Seven.
I mean,
I think that's it. Like, I can't be held down, like, you know, anymore.
Was that hard for you to write about that? I mean, it was a shock to read.
Yeah. But I think it was good. Good for me.
Still painful.
Yeah, what? This has been a rough week. It's just so odd, you know. It's like, you know, when your friend who doesn't even think she's in the book had no idea, and that was the friend who was like, your t-shirt's on inside out. I said, Jane, I had no idea. You know, you just don't even know what just happened.
Yeah.
And so I didn't realize it until a phone call, like in my late 30s. So, you know, I think I'm crying more for her.
Your friend. Because what?
She feels bad.
Yeah.
They're my life. They're
your friends.
Yeah.
Her friends and her staff ground her here. Bobby, one of her chefs, just read her book.
It's really just like talking to her. Just like she was right there in my living room.
What do you think of her story?
Like a classic hero's tale here in Boston, I think.
Or, as food critic Deborah First once famously put it, Barbara Lynch has quenelles, that's a little ball of fish or meat, of steel.
Let's talk about your business. I loved how you handled when you were running one restaurant, you were coming against some resistance from the staff, and you just gathered everybody together and said, look, this is how we're going to do it. If you don't like it, leave.
Yeah.
But then I'm stunned to read your own company, as you were handing over some of the reins to other management types, mm-hmm. tried to, like, ease you out a bit.
Yeah. I ended up really ill after giving birth. It put me out of commission for about 14 weeks, and then I got a phone call that my kitchen staff was going to pull a mutiny. They can't work with the people I gave a third of my business to. So I tried to get them on the phone for 2 days, and they wouldn't reply back. And then I just got off my deathbed and went in and went right to the sources and couldn't believe what I was hearing, blah, blah, blah. And it only comes
from the top. You're being phased out. It's your company.
Trying to be phased out. Yeah. Being called a lunatic, da, da, da. So just bought one out and at a hefty price. You know, it's amazing when you are just continuously called, what does she know? She's just a kid from the projects. Could piss you off, you know, and then that's when I learned how to run the business.
And but you built this, obviously.
I know. It's amazing. It's amazing when they can spend other people's money or...
We will have the best Monday ever!
Yes, chef, we will have the best Monday ever.
Is that...
We, chef.
Is that, that's the cry, the rallying cry from the kitchen?
Yeah.
I can't believe... Something I just heard you say. People might have in recent years have said, what does she know, a kid from the projects? I mean, yeah. How about in your own head? Have you gotten over that? Are you sure of who Barbara Lynch is?
Oh, yeah. I am so sure, and I'm so happy right now who I am. I always had that goal of, like, I want to be Joelle Robuchon. I want to be, you know, like the carrot. And I'm so happy I'm Barbara Lynch. Look how much I never used to look at, like, holy like, I've done a lot, and I'm only, like, 53.
You can still be president.
No, thanks. No, thanks.
Chef Barbara Lynch at her Boston restaurant, Number 9 Park. Her others are Montand, Stir, Sportello, Drink, B&G Oysters, and The Butcher Shop. For an excerpt of her great memoir, Out of Line, A Life of Playing with Fire, go to hereandnow.org.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
And it has been a bumpy day for the markets, with the Dow dropping more than 200 after the opening bell. The NASDAQ also fell by 1% this morning. Japan's Nikkei stock average saw its biggest drop since mid-April. So what's going on? Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us now in the studio for a look at the markets and some other concerns. Kurt, what's behind what we're seeing in the markets?
I remember sitting in the same chair after the election, and the stock markets were way up. And the reason was investors thought that Republicans in power, holding the White House and Congress, would cut taxes, unleash business so that the economy would grow and jobs would be created and good times would be had by all. This is just showing that investors are starting to question whether the White House can execute, can actually get some of the stuff done that they were expecting was going to happen.
And this is the concern among Republicans, that we're kind of distracted by a lot of things coming out of the White House that have nothing to do with tax reform, and they really want to be able to get that through. Well, we'll keep an eye on the markets, but let's talk about some new concerns being raised after last week's global ransomware attack, which we know hit a lot of health systems around the world. Now, new concerns that medical devices
could be vulnerable to future attacks. Tell us more.
Yeah, so researchers have found that they can actually go into things like pacemakers and insulin pumps and defibrillators, and they can actually steal patient information, flatten the device's battery, or send malicious messages to the pacemaker. Mm-hmm. So this is all in theory at this point, but researchers have shown that, you know, they can actually, hackers could do something that threatens people's lives.
Has it ever happened?
It hasn't happened. There have been cases where insulin pump makers have disclosed to the FDA that they had some vulnerabilities.
Right.
There have been malware attacks in hospitals where medical devices and medical equipment have been compromised, but usually to get backdoor access into hospital-like IT systems, not necessarily into patients. But it's a big concern.
Sure. Well, what are hospitals supposed to do?
Well, they've got purchasing power, right? They are the ones who buy all this stuff. And so they are significant. They've got the power of the purse. They can say to these companies, please disclose your vulnerabilities,
right,
your risks, what we can do about it. That's number one. They also can do, like any organization, do what it needs to do and make sure that they reduce risk of threats coming into the hospital or into the system from outside through training and through technology. And finally, you know, they need to talk more with each other. And if something comes up in one place, they need to know about it.
Well, Harvard Business Review has a piece on the very best cybersecurity, which is training employees.
Yeah. So the researchers in this one write that, you know, human forms of malware are curiosity, ignorance, apathy, and hubris. So, actually, most of the threats in companies come because people have made mistakes. And so training people, not spending millions of dollars on equipment and technology, but just training people to be smarter goes a long ways.
Yeah. I mean, you could have human malware just if your people aren't noticing something. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Thanks as always.
You got it.
The United Nations this week threatened North Korea with new sanctions following the country's latest missile launch. If confirmed, the results of North Korea's latest test suggest it could hit targets as far away as Guam, where the U.S. has a military base. That has further raised tension between North Korea, South Korea, and the United States. But to understand the situation on the Korean Peninsula, it helps to understand the Korean War. So to do that, let's bring in Catherine Weathersby, a visiting professor of history at Korea University. She joins us from Seoul by Skype. And Professor, take us back to the split at the end of World War II when we got two Koreas.
It happened rather accidentally. At the end of the war against Japan, the Soviets occupied the North and the Americans occupied the South. They were supposed to agree on creating a provisional government that would create a new government for Korea, but they had opposite goals. And so in 1948, two separate governments got created. But the key thing is both of them believed that they were the government of all of Korea. And that is still essentially the situation. So there are rival governments. It's not just that there are two governments. They are rival governments.
The war itself was very brutal. I read that the U.S. dropped more explosives on North Korea in that war than it did in the entire Pacific theater of World War II.
Yes, it did. And I think the bombing is really important because it was so unbelievably destructive. I saw a Soviet report by an official who was sent to North Korea at the end of the war to assess the damage because the Soviet government knew it would have to rebuild. And the estimate was that 85% of all buildings in the entire country were destroyed. Now, in the entire country.
Yeah.
It's a level of destruction that no other country has experienced.
Why was it like that? Why was this war so vicious?
Well, it became a stalemate by the spring of 1951, after beginning the summer of 1950. Once the U.S. and other U.N. countries entered on behalf of the South, and then the Chinese entered on behalf of the North, they reached a point where neither side could advance. It's important that Korea is a mountainous country because that means that both sides could dig into the mountains to put their artillery pieces in fortified concrete bunkers. And when that happens, and when there are enough of them, and there are thousands of them, neither side can advance because they would be, you know, overwhelmed by artillery fire from the other side. And with that being the situation on the ground and the armistice negotiations dragging on just endlessly, the U.S., out of frustration, did the only thing that it could do, which was to bomb. It just bombed and bombed and bombed. And then, you know, it ran out of targets and it just kept bombing again, bombed the same targets over and over and over. It's not difficult to imagine the kind of fear that created.
And the war went on for 3 years, but the war never really officially ended, did it?
No, it only concluded with an armistice in July of 53, which normally just is a temporary ceasefire to create the conditions for negotiating a peace treaty. But a peace treaty was never negotiated. All we have is the presumably temporary ceasefire that's been in place now since 1953. It's quite extraordinary.
Why is the war referred to in the U.S. sometimes as the Forgotten War?
Oh, I think because it was basically a tie. The dividing line is close to where North and South Korea were divided in the first place. But because it wasn't a great victory like World War II, there wasn't much to celebrate. And then after Vietnam, the attention was taken by Vietnam. So, yeah, but certainly the war is not forgotten here.
Yeah.
It's very much alive here on the peninsula. And it's not forgotten in China either.
Well, and how did it get us to where we are today? How much does the Korean War from the 1950s have to do with the situation on the Korean Peninsula right now?
Well, I think there's several important legacies. One is the bombing that I mentioned a minute ago, the fear. But beyond that, the war also produced quite considerable distrust of North Korea's allies. North Korea's relationship with China is very fraught. At the same time, it knows that because China doesn't want chaos on its border with Korea, and Russia doesn't want chaos on its border, both of them are going to keep supporting North Korea. And so North Korea has been in this position of being able to do quite outrageous things, knowing that its patrons are not going to desert it. I would say one other thing, too, that's important to keep in mind. South Korea, as we know, has become fantastically successful economically. So the specter of being absorbed by the South in the way that East Germany was absorbed by West Germany is quite frightening. The North is extremely vulnerable. You know, in 1989, it lost its allies in Eastern Europe when all of the Soviet bloc countries got rid of their communist governments. All of them had been supporters of North Korea. Mm. And then before the Soviet Union fell apart, it decided to make relations with South Korea because it was so desperate for economic aid, which is really ironic. I mean, the Soviets turned to Seoul to bail them out.
Well, and all along, by the way, the Kim family has been in charge in North Korea, right since the war.
Yes, yes. Well, since before the war, since the Soviets moved in to North Korea in 1945. Yeah, they chose Kim Il-sung to be the leader, and then his son and now his grandson are still there. So it's a dynasty.
Was that the way that the government worked in Korea before, or is that a new phenomenon for the country?
No, Korea was certainly a dynasty before the period of Japanese rule that began in 1910. So in that sense, it's quite normal. But when South Korea was established in 1948, there was no consideration of reviving the monarchy. So for people in the South, the fact that the North Koreans have basically a dynasty seems rather ridiculous. Hmm.
So it sounds like what you're saying is it's unlikely, given how different these places are at this point, that there's going to be some grand reunification anytime soon. What about another war? Is that more likely?
Well, the North's development of nuclear weapons and its quite energetic missile program is adding a new wrinkle to this situation. At the same time, on another level, the society in the North is changing quite dramatically. New moneyed classes of people are being created who are much more independent of the state than North Korean citizens ever have been. Money now talks rather than membership in the party. You know, once money is the issue rather than ideology, it's much easier to deal with people. It's much easier to come up with solutions. Hmm. And the North are not ideological zealots like ISIS or Taliban. In fact, they really don't have any ideology at all, I would say, by this time, other than trying to keep the system going. One other important thing is that if they were absorbed by the South, they would be at the very bottom of the social structure. And they know that. Those at the top would likely be put in jail. They have a more immediate reason to keep their system going. But even those at the kind of middle level of the society would basically lose everything. You know, I mean, is Samsung going to hire a factory manager from North Korea? Well, you know, not likely.
Well, but what it sounds like you're saying is that after all these years, even if South Korea is obviously the much more successful of the two, that North Korea is holding a lot of cards in the situation and keeping the system the way that it is now.
Yeah, we call this the leverage of the weak. They're quite skillful, at using the leverage of the weak.
That's Catherine Weathersby, who's a professor at Korea University in Seoul, South Korea. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Belmont University in Nashville is going public with an extraordinary gift it received from the will of the reclusive heir of a musical family, 500 vintage instruments. The multi-million dollar collection includes some of the finest guitars and mandolins ever made. A new gallery on campus brings them out of hiding and makes some of them available for musicians to play. Amy Eskin of Here and Now contributor WPLN reports.
The nearly $10 million worth of old instruments were donated by Stephen Kern Shaw. He was the son of the famous bandleader Artie Shaw and grandson of Jerome Kern, the beloved composer of classics The Way You Look Tonight, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and Old Man River.
Old Man River, that old man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing, he just...
But Shaw didn't have the musical talent of his father and grandfather.
He was a collector and hoarder.
That's George Gruen, owner of Nashville's Gruen Guitars, which buys and sells vintage instruments. He says Shaw was a frequent customer over decades.
He was not a great player. His basic income throughout life was, frankly, royalties from Jerome Kern, which supported his collecting habits.
Shaw had multiples of many fine instruments, and some of these were true gems. Gruen, who has encyclopedic knowledge about vintage guitars, knows extraordinary when he sees it. He values one guitar at $350,000. Gruen says they are not only musically important, but they are also pieces of art.
This Martin 00028 was made in 1912. And it has genuine ivory friction pegs, the bindings here, everything that looks white is real ivory.
After some work by Gruen, the instruments produced the sound they were made to deliver.
And we'll get out a 1927 Gibson F5 mandolin. This is more rare than a Stradivarius violin. Yeah, Bill Monroe, when he got an F5 mandolin, his entire playing style changed. If you listen, it was only after he got an F5 that he started to do that chop rhythm that could drive the rhythm of a five-piece band.
While the instruments have historical importance, they've been out of circulation for decades.
we didn't really get to see them much because, I mean, frankly, his house, when we finally got into it, looked a lot like some of those TV shows about hoarders and the compulsive hoarders. He wouldn't let anyone in his house. He was afraid that people would find out what he had and break in.
Grun discovered, to some alarm, that his friend, in his 70s and ill with liver disease, had not written a will and hadn't made plans for the collection after his death.
And I persuaded him that he really needed to have a will. The idea that it could be enjoyed by others and seen and heard was something that was pleasing to him, although he didn't want that done till after he was dead.
Shaw's will was signed a mere 2 weeks before his death in 2015, bequeathing the entire collection to Belmont University. But University President Bob Fisher says he had to think twice about offering a home to the collection.
My first response, too, was 500 guitars. What in the world do you do with them? Where do we put them?
Fisher may lead a renowned music school, but he needed a lesson himself in the rarefied world of vintage instruments.
I always was wondering, what's the difference between my old Silvertone guitar and a Martin anyway? Well, now I know. It's big.
Fisher quickly realized Belmont is the perfect fit for the collection. There is a distinct guitar culture across campus, says Doug Howard, dean of the Curb College of Entertainment and Music Business. And he says it's not just among guitar majors, although there are plenty. Even nursing students strum.
You can go to any major, and there's going to be a dorm room open, and everyone's got a guitar.
Students will be able to practice and play on these guitars and mandolins for their recitals and concerts, and that excites Howard.
It's just hard in life to think about a situation where you'd have an opportunity to really check out and play some of the really finest instruments that have ever been made. And to have that access, maybe steps and doors away from, you know, your dorm room.
The Gallery of Iconic Guitars, already nicknamed the Gig, is tucked behind the Belmont Library circulation desk. The gallery's initial display of 100 instruments is open to students and the public for a small admission fee. University officials are still figuring out a secure checkout system for the additional 400 prized instruments. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Eskind in Nashville.
And we have a couple pictures and a link to many more pictures at hereandnow.org. Look, there's the Gibson F5 mandolins. It's terrific. Take a look. Quick note, this afternoon on All Things Considered, the upfronts are underway in New York. That's when the TV networks show off their new shows to potential advertisers. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans will look at what's coming this fall and what shows in the current lineup you better watch quick because they will not be returning. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.